Aloha and welcome to Our Homes, Ending the Housing Crisis. I'm today's host, Ian Ross. I'm a former legislative aide to Senator Stanley Chang. My background is in public policy and advocacy, where I've worked in a variety of roles for the last 9 years, both in the legislature, as well as in grassroots organizing and advocacy. As a side note, I actually spent 8 years of my life in Australia with my whole dad's side of the family still living in Australia. So today's topic is of extra interest to me. The topic for today's webinar is the big housing build in Victoria, Australia. To help us learn more about the Victoria, Australia's big housing build, an ambitious plan to build 10,000 new affordable homes, is Parliamentary Secretary Sheena Watt. Sheena Watt is an Australian politician who has served in the Victorian Legislative Council for the Northern Metropolitan Region since 2020. She's the first Indigenous Australian woman to represent the Australian Labor Party in the Parliamentary of Victoria. She's the point person for the Big Housing Build, and this ambitious social housing plan, and which will be building these homes across the regional Victoria area. Mahalo for joining us today, Parliamentary Secretary.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so very, very much to you, Mr. Ross, and first and foremost to Senator Chang for the invitation. This is a really exciting opportunity to share with you all some of the things that are happening in my home state down about a 10.5 hour flight away. And I begin, as is my cultural custom and protocol, by acknowledging the First Peoples, the Indigenous peoples of Australia. I am in Melbourne, as you mentioned, and that's home for more than 60,000 years to the Wurundjeri people of the Greater Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present. My connections are a little bit further north up on river country in a place called Yorta Yorta country. So I'm a freshwater baby, as we say. So I acknowledge and pay my respects to their elders past and present. And can I just extend my respects to any First Peoples from other nations that may be joining us today, and acknowledge the work of any First Nations people involved in delivering safe and secure homes to our community. Now, I have a slide deck, and I'd like to just take a moment to share that now, if that's all right. Let me see if I can work on
it. Absolutely, please go ahead.
Now, has that come on up?
Yes, we can see it clearly. Thank you.
See that one? Lovely, lovely. So I'll just... where am I up to? Now, all right. So today really is a important day, as I get to share what it is that we do. And I'm really delighted to be here with you all. And it's really fantastic to have an opportunity to hear and share knowledge from our shared commitment to providing everyone in our community with a safe, secure place to call home. Programs such as the Big Housing Build, which I'll talk more about in a moment, have such an important role in our, you know, in the work that we do as a state. But the sharing of knowledge today really does continue to build our strong relationship that we have, and the many ties that we have with the United States. And as the closest state to Australia, it's worth acknowledging that as well. I hope that in coming together, we can celebrate and share what we've achieved so far, and hopefully leave you with some thoughts for the future. I am coming to you from Victoria. As I said, it's a small state on the in the big island home that we all love here. And of course, I'm quite far south. That's why we're in the middle of winter. That's why I'm all a little bit wrapped up at the moment. Of course, it is the southernmost part and the southernmost big city of Australia. Of course, we've got that small island state, Tasmania, a little further south. Now, I'm around, 5,500 miles from you today. Which I was told, I had to do some looking into this, is the equivalent of travelling from Los Angeles to New York and back again. So just for those folks who maybe haven't had the good pleasure that like you've had, Mr. Ross, of spending some time here in Australia. Now, Victoria is a incredibly vibrant, it's a multicultural, and it's really a thriving state. We are the fastest growing state in the country and have a population of 6.7 million. So, and I'm in the capital. Now, in March of this year, so only a few short weeks ago, our city, Melbourne, officially overtook Sydney to become the largest city in Australia. And Melbourne now has a population of 5.2 million people, which is projected to grow to 11 million by 2056. So I hope that that's helpful. Of course, there's some other stats there, which is a bit sooner, which is the 2041 getting to 8.4 million. Now, housing in Victoria is, well, there's certainly some things to talk about there. Housing growth, housing affordability, and housing attainability are key issues in our community, whether they live in Melbourne or our regional areas across our state. And I want to take some time in this webinar to outline some of the key drivers that put a range of pressure on our housing system and what our government has done in response to that. I'll take a moment to cast our minds back to the first half of 2020. And there were certainly pressures on our housing system. And of course, the coronavirus pandemic was having an enormous impact. At that time, housing affordability had deteriorated more in Australia than in comparable countries overseas. This had come about because over the last 20 years, average capital city dwelling prices had risen 200% compared to an 82% rise in wages. And at the same time, there were pressures on our housing system from increased numbers of people experiencing homelessness. And there were around 53,000 people on the social housing waiting list, and many, many more experiencing rental stress in the private rental market. The cost of purchasing a home continues to rise, and very few private rentals are affordable to people on the lowest incomes. Many of our essential workers, those that we value most, I'm talking about our teachers, our nurses, our police, our first responders, were also finding it hard to access housing that was affordable but also close to employment. And for us, the pandemic certainly highlighted the importance of having a safe and secure home. And it's made us change the way we thought about home, the way we think about community, and the way we think about work. And it also led to some dislocations in the housing market. Now, regional areas in our state are a good example of this, where declining affordability was coupled with a significant decrease in the availability of homes. As people left the capital to wait out the pandemic in our regional areas, and this had an enormous impact, of course, on our state, but mostly our regional communities, and we did see a sharp uplift in folks experiencing rental stress in the regional areas of our state, and it certainly grew the waiting list for public housing. So we also had during that time, and you know, there were many stories about how it was that we addressed the pandemic, but we had some public health emergency measures that came into place that really were very much with an eye to the housing market. This included a moratorium on rental evictions and a changing dynamic in the private rental market. So this meant that our social housing demand remained high and waiting list numbers grew. As I said, we had folks leaving the capital to go out to regional Victoria. Our low-income regional communities weren't able to then be able to access regional housing. We had a real uplift in numbers applying for government supported housing in regional areas. And what we did very much so was to seek advice and took some steps forward to respond to that. So what came about was the big housing build. So in November of 2020, the government announced a $5.3 billion investment. So that's, I'm just going to talk in all Australian dollars. So that's a $5.3 billion Australian investment into the big housing build to deliver an ambitious goal of 12,000 new homes across the state by 2026. So the big housing build was designed to deliver a net increase of 10% in social housing supply in around a four-year time period. The big housing build is the largest single investment in social and affordable housing in our state's entire history. And it's worth noting here, it's the biggest investment in all of Australia, and that includes by the federal government. So none have equaled the enormous investment of $5.3 billion into social and affordable housing like we have. So this was enormously ambitious. There's no shying away from that. We created a specialist delivery agency to make it come to life, and we called that Homes Victoria. And from the outset, we were really clear about what Homes Victoria and the big housing build was about. It's more homes for more Victorians. But it was also critically about delivering quality homes. So, as I said, these were some of the key drivers. There were 57,000 people on the wait list, and the big housing build has carried a really strong commitment to deliver homes that were really well designed and environmentally sustainable. As I said earlier, our winters are cold and our summers are really warm. So that means that we need homes that are well designed, but comfortable, efficient to run, and cheaper to keep cool in summer and warm in winter. All of the new homes, and this is worth folks knowing, all of the new homes have been designed to meet a 7-star nationwide housing energy rating scheme, energy efficiency standards. So the 7 number is very new for us, but we're being quite bold and ambitious about having energy efficiency in these homes. There's no use moving in really vulnerable people into beautiful homes if it takes all their spare money just to pay the energy bills, and that to us didn't make sense. So we wrapped up very strongly into that, some strong targets around energy efficiency and having a 7-star energy efficiency rating scheme attached to this program was incredibly important. Now, what we can see is we had some other objectives beyond just energy efficiency, because whilst that was great and we had some, some really strong targets, there were some other things that we thought we could be bold enough to challenge ourselves on as we went about building these 12,000 homes. So we also set out that it would support key cohorts and to deliver an extensive range of social and economic benefits. Now, beyond building $5.3 billion in homes, we expect that it will deliver $6.7 billion in economic activity across the state, and the big housing build will create a jobs boom. And those jobs, they need to be for the young and the inexperienced as well. So there will be 40,000 jobs created across the 4 key years of the program. And we have mandated that 10% of all work on these projects will be undertaken by apprentices and trainees. and including opportunities to increase female participation in construction. We have some gender equity challenges and gender equality challenges in the construction industry in our state, and we're taking that on by making sure that when the government is building things that we are providing opportunities for women to, you know, take a job and thrive. Of course, there will also be opportunities within these apprenticeships and cadetships and these traineeships as well to have opportunities for social housing renters. So we thought maybe there's something about being involved in the building of your own home that's really quite special. And so seeing folks that are already in public housing or government housing, I'm not sure what the term is that you use there, taking up opportunities to take on an apprenticeship and, you know, and build a home for the first time is incredibly special. So I'm also very pleased to talk a little bit about where these homes are going, because it is really very clear that putting them all in the capital city is not going to be ideal for us. There are all these housing pressures, as we said, out in the regional areas of our state. So a quarter of the big housing build, or that's about $1.25 billion, is being invested in new housing in our regional areas to create much needed housing in our growth cities and our tourism areas. We have very strong tourism in regional Victoria. We've got a number of great foodie places. We've got some marvellous, you know, ancient places that attract people from all over the world, but we've got challenges in finding affordable housing for the workers to support our tourism industry in regional Victoria. So it was great to see that. But we've also got some regional areas that might not have tourism opportunities, and they are a little underserved when it comes to, you know, social and community services, as well as having, you know, the workers live there. And so it becomes a real challenge for us. And so I'm really pleased to say that we are also looking at underserviced regional communities. We have mandated that 10% of the new, 10% of the, no, wait up, where am I up to? Oh yeah, I mentioned that. Sorry, I've realised I've left myself behind. 10% of the new social housing in the big housing build will deliver to Aboriginal Victorians in line with our commitment to providing more housing opportunities for Indigenous peoples from our state, and also that they will be self-determined by Aboriginal people and Aboriginal specific housing providers. So that's your we've got a number of Indigenous specific housing providers, and we'll be working with them to deliver these housing to them. So we've also know that there are a number of vulnerable cohorts. They include people escaping family violence. And we also have a commitment as a result of a recent Royal Commission, which is a large-scale inquiry into mental health in our state. So we will be having 2,000 homes will be provided for people experiencing mental illness. We've also got 1,000 homes specifically earmarked for people escaping family violence. And of that, around 250 have already been funded. Those homes for victim survivors of family violence, we understand that there are additional requirements, and so they are maintained and built to a very high safety standard. Some of them may include cameras and other measures, additional locks, fences, etc., just to, you know, bring that peace of mind to family violence victim survivors. And so it's really exciting to see that there are safe and appropriate housing for victim survivors and their families. So that's for us something that we're enormously proud of, but we're keeping a very sharp eye on. Up to 1,100 homes, that's 1,100 homes, will be built through an innovative, what we call a ground lease model approach. Now, this is where public land owned by the state is leased from Homes Victoria, that's the agency I spoke about earlier, to a project group that will finance, design and construct new housing. So this is usually, we've got a not-for-profit community housing provider that will manage and maintain each housing site for 40 years before handing the land and all the dwellings back to the state. So an example of that might be a women's specific or a family violence specific housing provider. They know what needs to happen to build safe, secure housing for victim survivors, and we work with them. It could also be a someone that specializes in mental health appropriate housing models, or it could be a provider that might understand that region and what works, particularly where we might have higher needs as a result of natural disasters and emergencies. We have some areas that have high susceptibility to floods and fires in our state. And so we are working on with some specialist providers on that. These sites will deliver an integrated model of social, affordable and specialist disability. And that's a big one as well. And market rental homes that are welcoming, secure and meet our modern design and accessibility standards. Now, this is, next slide is, if I go back to this other one, see these towers here, you can see them. That is our high density public housing towers that we've had in the state since about the sort of 60s, 70s. That was the original model of how we used to do it. They are all home to, they're still currently occupied, but you can see that site down below where we're building something new and exciting. Now, this next slide is Ascot Vale, which is a suburb in our state. It is sort of an inner city suburb. I'm talking from the middle of the city to get to Ascot Vale, 20 minutes is probably, I think, a fair estimation. This project here that's been recently completed features 100 social homes and 100 affordable rental homes, and as you can see, features some really high quality design. This is our recent, I'll go to our next one. This is Ashburton. This is a little bit further out. We're talking more the sort of 45 minutes zones from the central business district. In Melbourne, this features 111 public housing homes and 67 affordable rental homes, and will create that real integrated community. Our projects are well located within, very close distance to our train station, shops, sports and school grounds. All our homes are tenure blind. I'm not sure if that's a term that's familiar to you, but tenure blind means that big housing build new homes do not look any different from other new homes coming onto the market. Now, if you fast forward to today, we have we've now just over 2 years into our big housing build. We now have 7,600 homes in planning or construction, and we have $3 billion in contracts. 2,000 households have either moved in or have their bags packed, and they're very, very keen and eager to move in. We have 900 sites across Victoria in our pipeline, and this on your screen can give you a sense of the size and diversity of the big housing build and where we're up to right now. So we're pretty proud, I've got to say. As you can see from our next slide, which I'll just get to now, there's the different sites there, and I think I'll just see if I can play that for you.
Biggest ever investment in social housing by any state or territory.
The state government's vowed to pump more than $200 million into social housing.
79 social housing units are being built in the Latrobe Valley.
Hundreds of social housing units are being built across the inner suburbs. Developments of 25 new homes in Horsham, a new housing complex in Dandenong.
The investment's expected to create more than 900 jobs.
To create more than 130 Western Victorian jobs.
The development is now well underway and tenants should be able to move in by early 2024.
This will change lives, it will save lives.
It's an apartment block offering safe, permanent accommodation to women and children with support services built in. As demand grows, social and affordable options are being boosted.
In the last 12 months, we've done 33 homes here.
It is expected to welcome its first residents mid-next month.
Hundreds of vulnerable Victorians now have a roof over their head, with more than 1,000 new dwellings built across the state to help tackle homelessness.
Almost 100 new homes have been completed in Ballarat, with more than 200 still being constructed as part of the state government's big housing build.
The latest grants from the Social Housing Growth Fund are going to make a massive difference in Mildura and in Swan Hill too.
114 modular homes are being built across the state, including in Warrnambool, Portland, Colac and Ararat, at a cost of $30 million.
Well, the big housing build is actually beginning to have an impact already. There are 200 homes either under construction or already delivered in the Bendigo area.
Being in my own home, I feel safe.
Having a secure housing, it's had a massive impact on my life.
There's no way to describe the way I feel. It's just an amazing feeling to be given this, to be given the opportunity to live again.
Biggest ever investment in
so. There you go. So as you can see, there is a lot happening and the big housing build in our state is coming to life. You can hear the stories of people, which to me is just so very powerful. But when someone gets their keys for the first time, that is all the joy you'll need to see. This is really life-changing. And in this year, we expect to unveil around 3,200 new homes. And this will be the most homes ever opened in a single year in Victoria by the state. So this is incredible. And with each new home, we're growing the social housing sector itself. And importantly, with every new home, we are easing pressure on the housing system. Of course, there is some innovation wrapped up in this that we're worth exploring, I think, today. Our vision for creating the big housing build and Homes Victoria was to deliver certainty and thousands of homes to people in our state. We also thought that maybe there's some opportunity for innovation as well. So you can see from those designs from the video, and I hope that was clear for you all to see. That we responded by having a sort of a real co-design process, and where lived experience of people was really valuable. That's why having, you know, people that were victim survivors of family violence talk to us about what they're looking for in safety wise in their new home. It mattered. And it mattered. And, you know, you heard the stories about people feeling safe for the first time. We're also seeing that agencies from other states are showing a real interest and they're wanting to set up here. We're pretty proud of that because, you know, anytime that we can, you know, attract some new interest into our state to help support our most vulnerable is a very good thing. We've also got some end-of-life assets, including a real need to redevelop some of them. And you've seen those towers that I showed earlier. And so one of the redevelopments that was recently announced in our election, which was in November of last year, was to put air conditioning units in them. They don't actually have air conditioning units. And so for the first time, we'll be seeing air conditioning units going to those towers. It's going to make an enormous difference. And that's heating and cooling. So those split system arrangements. Now, there are also a few of those agencies moving into regional areas. Like I said, you know, some of these areas are underserviced and have been for a long time. But through this critical investment, these organisations are feeling that there's enough support for them to venture out into regional areas. We're also seeing a large number of private investors coming onto the horizon with some new and interesting and innovative ways of thinking. So we are really, really, delighted to hear some new ideas. And even yesterday, I was out hearing some, meeting some folks with some rent-to-build models and others. And right throughout, the projects carry an overall commitment to quality design, energy efficiency, durability, and that neighbourhood integration. You can see the quality of these homes in that video and what that means for the neighbours. These are not going to be eyesores in the community. They're places that people are really proud to live and proud to see go up. Of course, as I said, part of that pride also comes from the tenure blind model, that nobody walking down the street knows that that's an apartment block for social housing. It's just not known. And for us, that's a really good thing. In the 60s and 70s and even, later on, we built all these homes and everybody knew which were the public housing homes, because they all had the exact same fence. They were built to be exactly the same. They're on the same spot on the land. The roof was the same. Everybody knew. Even the letterboxes are all the same. That is over. And I am really proud of tenure blind models and am championing them as much as I can. I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to talk to you about all the things that we're doing here in our state, and I hope that there's some good questions to come to me, and I look forward to talking to you again. But thank you to you, Mr. Ross, and of course Senator Chang, for your time today and the opportunity to talk to you about the big housing build. And I'll hand it over to you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for that really engaging presentation and helping us learn more about this very ambitious project. It's really exciting to see how much of it is coming online in such a short time horizon. Very often we talk about these ambitious plans, you hear about them. There's a whole lot of commitments 10, 20 years down the line. So it's always very exciting to hear about the stuff that's coming on almost immediately. So before we get to some of the questions, and I do want to remind everyone, you could submit questions down at the bottom. It says Q&A. You can click it and put some questions. I want to give a little bit of context from some folks. So right now, the Australian to US dollar, because you were talking in Australian dollars.
Yes.
So for our audience, might appreciate it's currently 0.68, or $1 can be traded for 1.47 Australian dollars. Which you had mentioned tourism earlier in Victoria. It tells me I really need to come visit Australia soon.
Please do.
Additionally, as someone who is a former resident of Australia, I was actually really surprised when I saw the news earlier this month that Victoria had overtaken Sydney. Being like an eight-year-old in Australia, it always seemed like Sydney was like the one really big thing going on. So it's so fascinating to hear how vibrant and fast-growing Victoria. So thank you for that little view of things.
Yes.
So yeah. The big...
Took some of us by surprise too, can I just say?
So was it something more recent that population growth was turned to overdrive, or has this been a slow and steady wins the race kind of situation?
More the former, I think. We were on track in this... years before COVID, but COVID sort of took a lot of people left our state during that time and thought, I'll go up north to the sun and the surf, but people have returned here for the opportunities, and people have come back as well that we might not have anticipated, but quite a few folk have gone, yeah, you know what, there's a lot to Melbourne to like, so I think I'll come on back. So yeah,
some folks are going to make a whole lot of political waves writing a demographics book about how the pandemic shifted everyone's expectations of the world.
Yeah.
So one big question that's come up from our folks, and I did tell you early on that they'd be a little bit wonky, so we're keeping true to it. Dennis and an anonymous viewer asked, can you talk about more about financing? Specifically, they want to hear more about the construction side and financial supports offered to the residents, as they were noting that it appears that you're offering sub-market rental rates.
Ah, yes. Well, firstly, thanks, Dennis, for the question. Rightio. Now, let me talk a little bit about that question of financing. This has been financed entirely from the state and the state budget. So we did seek support for this from the federal government at the time, noting, of course, that, you know, we had a very, very big list and lots of folks that were experiencing homelessness. Ultimately, under our constitution, the responsibility to address homelessness is a federal responsibility, and they, through a partnership with the states, actually, you know, we deliver lots of the services or do a fair bit. But no, that was entirely funded by the state. So there you go. We've also got a lot of, you know, assets as a state as well. So I'll just have a look and see if I can find some details around that. So we have, like I said, there's a sort of agreement that happens between all of the states and territories and the federal government. That's called our National Housing and Homelessness Agreement. And that equates to about, I don't know, like $1 billion a year. So we use that to then support frontline homelessness and family violence services. And there is really no ongoing funding for us to do the upgrade of the homes. So that is done entirely through rentals of the, you know, rentals. So just so you know, we have a kind of calculation that's done for folks that live in these homes. So you can't, under our rules, a vast majority of these folks are on statutory incomes. These are their pensions and age pension or disability pensions, or they might be seeking employment, and we have a sort of a job seeker program where you've, you know, funded for welfare by the state. Now, under our system, if you're in one of our homes, you can't pay more than 30% of your income in rent. So it is, that's how these things fund themselves. And there you go. So the state funded it. Obviously, we've been receiving income from tenants, and that's marked at a maximum of 30% of the income. Is that what you're looking for? I'm hoping so. If not,
yes, Dennis, I think that was
a question in, and I can get back to you.
I think you may have gotten most of it there. Anonymous, though, I'm going to let them jump the line because I think this is relevant on the question of financing. Are all the projects on state or government-owned land? Or does the state go out and acquire the land for this development?
Yeah, okay. So we have four different models when it comes to the land, right? So one is we're renovating or redeveloping, right? And existing houses, like I said, those towers earlier. Number two is we've got land that we owned. We've just never done, we haven't maximised it. Now, as you see from that earlier photo where we had the towers, we had that space in front. Now, that had been sort of, I don't know, a playground or grass or something, and we've just decided, or it could have, so that's owned by Homes Victoria or owned by the government agency responsible. Number three is, the third is that there's other government land. So it could be that we've got some land owned by the Railway Corporation. We have land that's owned by, I don't know, it could be a previously closed down hospital or a school that, you know, has been changed or moved or whatever. So there's a lot of land in the broader state government portfolio. And through agreement, we're able to, purchase that from one government agency, purchases it from another. That's really popular, particularly with those parcels of land that are near the train lines. The Victorian Rail Corporation actually owns a lot of land around train tracks. And so wanting to have places that are social and affordable housing near public transport has meant that we have gone very much to our friends at the Railway Corporation and said, what have you got for us? We're looking for something near the train lines, and they've been able to unlock some opportunities. So that's the sort of third model. And the fourth model is, of course, that we buy it on the open market. And we've done that as well. But the cheeky thing is, and I'll just let folks know, we don't tell them that we're the government, because as soon as they find out that the government is looking to buy this land, the prices mysteriously jump very, very high. Maybe don't tell folks that, but having somebody purchase that on our behalf or a sort of, a private agency is actually incredibly important for us to get that value for money. We know that people know that when the government's buying, you can, maybe we should, reconsider that price model. And so that's been really important for us as well. So they're the sort of four ways that we find land to build these 12,000 homes.
Your face lit up with that question, and I could just immediately tell this is one that you're like, yes, I get to show off some knowledge on this one.
Yeah, I've got to say, I have looked at spots for a really long time, and you didn't even think to imagine that that could be a home to some folks. Like, it could be a kind of a junkyard near a rail yard, and all of a sudden it's now a thriving community of that, of people. And how is it that we kept some of these places in such prime areas for community? We just kept them sitting there for all these months and all these years, rather, and sometimes decades. But through having a real focused look at it, we're able to unlock it and have some friendly conversations with our friends at the Railway Corporation. Yeah.
Wonderful. We always love to hear about some transit-oriented development, as we call it here.
Well, that's a good way to put it. Maybe I'll use that in the future.
Well, there we go. We're spreading TOD. So one of the questions that we wanted to ask you was, what are some of the biggest obstacles and resistance to development, including building new housing? It sounds like you have all of these approaches for acquiring land and what you're doing. So you must be working around some particular set of problems on a day-to-day basis. Can you tell us more about those?
Okay. One problem is that it's enormously challenging now in Australia to the construction market. It's we just don't have enough construction professionals to do the work that we wanted to. It wasn't like we had folks sitting around waiting in hope that they could be unlocked to deliver 12,000 housing pro 12,000 dwellings. So one was a real workforce challenge. Two was supplies. It's been enormously challenging to get supplies, particularly from the overseas market. We knew that, we've been impacted by the importation of wood products from Europe. That's, for us, one that was a little surprising, but has been enormously impactful. And having to pay quite a premium for construction products. And probably if I go to other challenges, one was about even thinking about the where. You know, we had folks that had traditionally had very higher density public and social and government housing. But we were bold enough to say, no, maybe it's worth us thinking about other areas, you know, that have been historically underrepresented when it comes to government housing. The ones that come to mind are, you know, our upper income areas, even our upper middle class areas. They didn't have high, you know, anywhere near the sort of density of government housing. So I know that there was a little bit of pushback. Surprisingly, not really. But, you know, everyone deserves a home, and these homes should be everywhere. So that's there's some of the challenges that happen, just, you know, supplies, you know, professionals and all the rest of it. Yeah. And also, yeah, challenges from neighbours and, yeah, I'm happy to go into that in a bit more depth if there's any interest in that one.
That was actually the next question about if there was any pushback. We call that sort of like movement or resistance here typically NIMBY or NIMBYism, not in my backyard is what it stands for. Is there a term for it in Australia? Oh, there you go. We got some overlap there.
Yes. We have NIMBYs, and we have folks that maybe subscribe to some very ancient thinking about people in public and social housing. So it was, you know, a big challenge. They're concerned about their housing prices. They're concerned about crime. They're concerned about, like, maybe having to see them. I don't know. There was all sorts of very, you know, strange and some very valid complaints that came up and challenges to, you know, plannings and whatnot. The truth is, when you went to put a an apartment block or a set of townhouses in the suburb in Melbourne that has the second highest level of household income, there was always going to be challenges, but we've pressed through, and it's extraordinary what the community has done. So some folks, not a fan, but then as the project went along, what we saw was different neighbours getting behind it. So the school kids, you know, wanted to volunteer to paint a wall and make a mural there, and some senior sits group made blankets for the new residents for when they moved in, and others have just done wonderful things to show that, no, hold up, you're welcome here. And that just sort of filled our spirits a little, that we yeah, we're pretty happy about that one, I've got to say. And yeah, even the crane, I recall this actually, there was the crane as it was in construction, oversight, actually had a kind of flag flying from it that, I don't know, that said something like, everybody's welcome here or something. It was just really beautiful. So and just making sure also that we tell many of the good stories as well. So we've done that. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. And that question was also from Betty. Let's see. The next thing I wanted to talk to you about was also a question from Betty. How long does it take to get permits to build a project? She knows it's a really big barrier here. And did you have to change any of the bureaucracy or policies to allow for this big build plan?
Yeah, Betty, your questions are excellent. firstly, as are the others, but this is one that I hadn't explored but is worth talking about. So as I said, the big housing build came up as a sort of economic stimulus project in part, as well as, a project to tackle the social problem of of our times. And with that, we knew that, if you're going to invest $5 billion in housing, that's enormous, but you cannot have that drag on for years and years and years in in the sort of permit approval process and state governments and local governments and challenges through the courts and other such things. And not to say that that's not all entirely valid, because it truly is. But what we really needed was to lay the foundations for that to be as easy as possible, frankly. And so there were some pandemic-specific planning changes that were made that enabled a great number of these projects to go through a lot easier than they had previously. So I'll just say that that was, for us, something that made these projects be in the position where you see now, where they're being completed and we've got 3,000 folks moving in this year and others previously. And you've seen in that video, there are many, many in the pipeline over the 4 years. So, that helped making the path to approvals a lot easier.
Sounds like you really had to approach this from a lot of directions at the same time and be flexible.
Yes.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, so I think we probably can delve into some of the bigger, one more bigger question.
If you'd like,
I think I could potentially rapid fire out four questions for you that might be able to have shorter answers if you're indulging. You want that? Okay, here we go. Anonymous asks, are there a set aside number of units for Indigenous populations, and how are these goals decided?
Okay. Yeah, as I said, we had I think it was 10%. I'll have to.
10%.
Whatever that was.
I may have recalled you saying that.
10, I think it's 10. Yeah, I think that sounds about right. They were decided in partnership with the responsible minister for Aboriginal Affairs, who we've got high rates of Indigenous homelessness in our state, and so we really kind of wanted to tackle that as a key cohort. So people had an opportunity to sort of bid in. You've got 12,000 places being built. It would be really good if some of them went to these key cohorts, and then there was an opportunity for people to kind of make the case that we really need some for, people experiencing mental health, victim survivors of family violence, Indigenous populations, over 55-year-old women, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was sort of a process prior to that announcement where different ministers were able to pitch speak with the housing minister and come up with, a really deliberative way to tackle some of those cohorts that have really, really, high numbers. Yeah.
Great, thank you. And just because our listeners might want to know this, the numbers I could find on the Australian government website is about 3.2% of Australians are Indigenous. I just wanted to give that context for our listeners.
Yeah. Yes. And so in our state, though, I don't know how it works there. We have dispersed across the nation. We're actually less than 1% in our state. So less than 1% of Victorians are Indigenous, whereas if you go up to the north, where it's those populations are far, far less. We're much more impacted by, colonisation and other things down here that are not great.
Thank you for that additional context. Next one, a former legislator, Galen Fox, asked us, mentioned that we can't build modular homes here because unions block the competition to old-fashioned home construction. Why don't Australian unions block modular construction? Is there any effort on that part? That last part is something I've added.
Because different unions are involved in the construction of modular homes, and that they're union jobs. So that helps. Whether they are, we've got a manufacturing workers union that are quite involved in the manufacturing of these homes, and they work in partnership. Of course, there is so much pipeline for construction work, and there is opportunities aplenty for construction workers that they're not kind of losing out, I think is probably worth saying. If you're a construction worker in this state, you've got an incredible chance to get and hold a high-paying, safe and secure union job in this state. And so there is not a there's very few risks to the union in terms of its aspirations, as well as we have some very high safety standards when it comes to the construction of modular home construction.
Well, there you go. Thank you for that information. Ken Farm asked two questions, but I see we're right on the hour now, so I'll just do one. And it's Ken Farm, I know this gentleman's favorite question to ask. It's about the definition of what constitutes affordability. In the United States, we often use area median income. What constitutes affordable in Australia and Victoria more specifically?
There is a definition that we have, and I'm just trying to find it, but I believe it is similar. It is actually a like a maximum of 30% of the median income of that particular geographic area. So we have two. We have a Melbourne, like the very, you know, the city, capital city based, and then we have a regional one as well. We split it. We don't have an affordable for the whole of the for the whole of the state. We split it into regional and capital.
It's really helpful. In the United States, very often we do anything under 140% the median, paying 30%. Do you line it up at exactly 100% for the median, or do you allow like wiggle room on either side of that?
We're still really landing. I mean, I think there's a government definition, but the sector itself has a different definition, and advocacy groups have a different one. We don't have a uniform position yet on the definition, I believe, of affordable housing in our country. So there's some work to be done on that. So thanks, Ken, for asking.
Well, Senator Stanley Cheng isn't a huge fan of the AMI model here, so perhaps you're doing yourself a favor by not necessarily all narrowing in on one definition. Well, Parliamentary Secretary Watt, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate hearing about all the exciting things going on in Victoria, and wishing you folks all the best there.
Lovely. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll catch you the next Our Homes. Aloha.